The headlines this hour. Crowds of mourners attend a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, who was assassinated on Sunday. Iranian rescue workers are racing against time to pull possible survivors from the rubble of a building that collapsed in the city of Abadan. And a political crisis deepening in Tunisia. The labor union prepares for a nationwide strike after rejecting a national dialogue proposed by the president. Thanks for joining us. We begin this hour in the Iranian capital, Tehran, where just hours ago, a funeral procession was held for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, who was assassinated on Sunday. Hundreds of mourners attended the event, many of them holding pictures of Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai and chanting slogans against the United States and Israel. Khodai was assassinated in his car and just outside of his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. The IRGC has called this killing an act of terrorism. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has pledged to avenge Khodai's assassination, saying that the response will be tough and make the enemies regret the heinous crime. Gisemisho Ahmadi was there to give us a feel of the atmosphere.
People who are taking part in the funeral procession of the IRGC colonel that was martyred, Hassan Sayyad Khodai. And of course, what's happened so far is that we've had a number of speakers speaking in honor of this martyr, and also special prayers were also performed. At first, they were planning to perform the prayers inside the mosque nearby, but the number of people that have attended in this funeral procession is so large that they had to perform the prayers right here in the square downtown Tehran. Now, after this funeral procession, which is almost towards the end, people will be marching from Imam Hussein Square to Shohada Square, bidding farewell to the body of the martyr, and from there, of course, he will be taken to his place of rest. Each and every person that I interviewed has reiterated that although this type of atrocious killing is very tragic and it makes them very upset, it definitely does not make them weaker, but in fact makes them even stronger in their resolve to fight global arrogance.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has returned home from his groundbreaking visit to Oman. Raisi says the visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations.
We don't have much economic relations, and over the past couple of months, our business relations has doubled and stands at over $1 billion. But we believe that there's a lot of potential in order to develop these relations further. And as far as business relations are concerned, both countries and high-ranking officials of the two countries have assigned MOUs in order to develop business and economic relations. In short, 13 MOUs and agreements were signed by the high-ranking officials of Iran and Oman, and this is considered a new page and a new chapter in our relations. Of course, we did have agreements that were signed before, but what really matters is for these agreements to be implemented. And of course, one issue that was brought up is that these MOUs are not implemented. So this trip is considered a beginning of a new era in order to start implementing these MOUs. The basic pillar of these agreements are mostly regarding fiscal cooperation and also health tourism. Another issue that is important is that the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman can help strong regional relations, and good relations between the two countries can increase cooperation in the region, which was discussed in this meeting and all of the meetings that we had with high-ranking Omani officials. And we are pursuing stronger relations both with Oman and in the region.
Earlier, we were joined by the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajare. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf region.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Rescuers are working hard to help people trapped under the rubble of a building that collapsed in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan. The incident has claimed the lives of 10 people. Their fear is that the number of casualties could rise, with reports saying that up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. Some 29 people have been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road, with surrounding buildings evacuated. An investigation is underway into the cause of the incident. The building's owner and contractor are in detention. And now let's listen to comments by the president of Iran's Red Crescent Society, Pir Hossein Kolivand, about the ongoing rescue operations at the site.
Rescue teams are working to their fullest potential. Operations are in progress at a higher speed thanks to the deployment of more and better equipment to the area. We are trying to access the underground level to save those trapped there. All buildings in the vicinity of the collapsed structure have been evacuated to protect residents from potential risks.
Iran's foreign minister says the United States' open support for Israel has further emboldened the occupying regime. The ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, says this has been worsened by international indifference to the regime's repeated acts of aggression against Syria. Khatibzadeh condemned Israel's recent missile strikes on Damascus, saying the regime's military is serving the air force of terrorist groups operating in Syria. He said that Israel launches attacks whenever the Syrian army scores a victory against terror outfits. The spokesman also underlined the need for a strong response to Israel's acts of aggression, both on the battlefield and at the international level. On Friday, Israel launched a large-scale missile attack on Damascus, killing three people and razing buildings near a key mosque in the city. To find international outcry over the recent killing of a Palestinian journalist, Israel says that there is no immediate suspicion of criminal activity in the case. The regime's military advocate says even if an Israeli soldier had fatally shot Shireen Abu Akleh, the soldier cannot be held guilty of criminal misconduct. The advocate says the death of the journalist in the midst of an active combat zone does not warrant a criminal investigation. The regime's military advocate is responsible for determining whether any soldier would face disciplinary action for the incident. On Monday, or on May 11th, Abu Akleh was shot and killed while covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank flashpoint city of Jenin. Her death drew strong international condemnation for the Tel Aviv regime. The Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, for which Abu Akleh was reporting, has accused Israel of killing her deliberately and in cold blood. Hamas has held a national conference in the Gaza Strip to mark the victory of the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance factions against Israel during the 11-day war in May 2021. Ashraf Shannon has more details.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Tunisia's political crisis is deepening. The country's labor union rejects the president's proposed national dialogue and says that it will hold a nationwide strike over economic woes. The UGTT says that it will not take part in an advisory committee set up by President Kais Saied to discuss political and economic reforms. The union says that it rejects any dialogue where roles are unilaterally determined. Last week, Saied designated a law professor to head the Committee of Legal and Political Science Experts to draft the new constitution. However, he barred political parties from any role in the process. The main opposition party, Ennahda, has also rejected Saied's move, saying that it lacks constitutional legitimacy. Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis since June 2021, when Saied dismissed the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. The president's opponents accuse him of a coup. Our correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Johnny Miller, reports from the Donbas region to find people who no longer wish to be a part of Ukraine.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbas People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartments 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, statues like this that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture, and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the Imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the Imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Peshwa near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini," and "Death to the Shah." Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the Imam's house. The Imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, "The sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead," had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the Imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, "But at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm." Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, "On June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them." Lady Saqafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. "People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance." She continues, "Near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, 'Are you scared?' They said, 'We have heard so.' I said, 'It is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape.' I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Ishraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has visited Oman. Not only does this trip build upon the brotherly ties that exist between the two countries, they discuss regional issues. Iran's President has said that regional countries should solve their problems and that foreign powers should not interfere and leave the region altogether. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the relationship between these two countries and look at the role that Iran plays when it comes to other countries in the region, including problem areas like Palestine and the presence of foreign forces. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Expert in West Asian Affairs Kevin Barrett joins us from Madison. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from Islamabad.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Kevin Barrett, and ask you about the visit by Iran's president to Oman. It was pretty wide in terms of the MOUs that were signed, 12 agreements, cooperation agreements from what we understand. So in terms of trade, it was obviously very fruitful. And prior to that, they revived the gas pipeline that was in the works for quite some time. How do you see this relationship in terms of its significance, especially for the region altogether?
Well, this is a very good move for Iran, Oman, and the whole region. The 12 cooperation agreements cover all kinds of ground. And as you suggested, one of the most important, probably the most important, is that gas pipeline issue. That's been in the works for well over a decade. And, of course, the Western powers, well, that's a euphemism, really, for the United States, which is largely under Israeli control when it comes to U.S. Mideast policy, has been blocking it and trying to find ways to make sure it doesn't happen. And now it may be that the Americans are of two minds. On the one hand, of course, they're still brutally sanctioning Iran. They're being completely unreasonable in their JCPOA negotiations. And they're obviously still under the thumb of the Zionists. But on the other hand, they have a huge problem on their hands in Ukraine, where, contrary to what the Western media tells us, Russia is achieving its objectives in this special military operation. And at this point, with energy prices soaring and Europe trying to find a way to live without Russian gas and oil, but gas being the biggest problem, and the U.S. Desperately trying to make sure the Europeans stay on this course of boycotting Russia and substituting liquid gas, the propane variety, for the gas they've been importing from Russia through pipelines from Russia. There's a huge market right now for this liquid gas that can be shipped overseas. And apparently Oman wants to manufacture that. And Iran has one of the largest, possibly about the largest, or tied for number one in terms of all gas reserves. So it may be a propitious time for this. And it may be a time for Iran to break out of its isolation, or it's not really isolated, of course. Iran is trading with most of the world, including the biggest countries like China, as well as Russia and many others. But it's been hammered by the West and the United States at the direction of the Zionists. But this may be a time to change that. And by breaking out and becoming a savvy player in regional diplomacy, building on this relationship with Oman, we could see a sea change in the region as other regional powers understand that the future of the region is in independence and autonomy and freedom from Zionism and imperialism.
Well, let's take a look at some of the stances taken. And one of the most important ones that came out of this meeting, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, is what Raisi noted about dialogue and cooperation, where he said the remarkable key point is that dialogue and cooperation among the regional countries creates security, would create security, but the presence of foreign forces would not, by any means, and could even threaten regional security. First of all, what do you think about that, and isn't that a direct reference to the U.S.?
It is absolutely a direct reference to the U.S. I think Iran has long held that the West Asia region, or the region surrounding Iran, must become much more autonomous, independent, and not reliant on the United States as the local policeman, which is exactly what the Arab world has largely facilitated. I mean, they've cooperated and collaborated in their own, if you like, their own subordination. And let's not forget that Donald Trump, for all his ills, he said it very, very plainly. He said, we're here to milk the cow. And he was referring to Saudi Arabia. But of course, that extends to Kuwait, extends to the United Arab Emirates, and all the Gulf region, really. And that's exactly what the Americans have been doing and can continue to do. And of course, Israel gets its benefits from that American boots on the ground, will support you militarily and strategically. What Iran is saying is that, look, we're here to stay. America's going to eventually leave. They don't belong in this region. They belong in the Americas. But when the oil runs out, when your gas runs out, when they no longer want to milk you as cows, what are they going to do then? Who are you going to turn to? So the reality is that the Arab nations need to think very, very deeply about their longer-term interests. And I think Iran has continually offered them a very reasonable alternative, and that is, first of all, I think, in trying to, even in President Rouhani's era, where he launched the Hope Initiative in the 74th session in the UN General Assembly. That Hormuz peace endeavor floundered with a counter, if you like, measure by the Americans and the Israelis to open up relations with the UAE and to sort of open up more relations with Bahrain, et cetera, the Moroccans too. But of course, this visit of Amir Abdullahian to Oman and meeting Sultan Haitham bin Tariq is a positive indicator from the Iranian policy perspective, in the sense that upgrading those cultural and political reactions or those relations, rather, to higher levels of economic and business cooperation, kind of set a pattern and a trend. And it's not an isolated trend, because Iran's Customs Administration spokesman, Ruhollah Latifi, said very recently that Iran's trade exchanges with its neighbors from March to December 2021 were valued at 92 million tons in volume and more than $46.2 billion in cash. And that constituted basically an increase of 13% in volume and 28% in monetary value from the year prior. Now, that also added to that is that Oman has had a 40% increase in its bilateral trade with Iran during the past year as well. So you can see that Iran is making inroads into creating not only that sense that there should be an independent West Asia, which really relies on its own economic power for itself, rather than being milked like a cow, as it has been done for maybe six or seven decades or more.
Sure. It's interesting, Kevin Barrett, our guest there, mentioned the Hope Initiative that was actually presented by the former Iranian President Rouhani at the UNGA. And made me think about one of the failed initiatives that the U.S. At one point had proposed years ago, and that was what we call West Asia, this region, the West Asian Arab NATO. Remember that? How it flopped? It didn't even take off. However, this initiative that Sayyid Mohsen Abbas talks about is something that actually Oman has taken the lead now on, that, insisting on continuing the cooperation with Iran to provide maritime security and to counter maritime terrorism in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Strait of Hormuz. So in that light, Oman has taken the lead, and that is very significant, isn't it?
Indeed, yes. This kind of security cooperation with Iran will ultimately be in the interests of other countries in the region as well, these countries that currently are experiencing you know, the difficulties of being essentially, if not exactly colonized, but certainly client states of a declining empire. And as the U.S. empire continues to decline, this whole notion of an Arab NATO and global NATO and so on will seem more and more absurd, because obviously what NATO really is it's a euphemism for the U.S. military occupation of Europe, which began after World War II and never ended. And the rest of the world doesn't particularly want to be occupied by a single unipolar hegemonic empire. There are better ways to ensure global and regional security that can also preserve the autonomy and independence and sovereignty of the nations involved. And of course, that is what Russia says it's ultimately fighting NATO about. And it's also what China, the rising number two power, espouses. And given the economic changes in the world, as the West's share of global GDP declines precipitously, clearly the future is in these kind of independent regional security arrangements between sovereign nations in a multipolar world, rather than everybody signing up for some super NATO and being occupied by the U.S. military in a unipolar world. That's a pipe dream. It's never going to happen.
Looking at the respective countries, which we will take a look at that, say, Mohsen Abbas, one thing that just stands out preventing security and stability to be established in the region, no matter practically wherever you look at, is Israel. Whether you look at Syria, whether you look at, for example, Iraq in terms of Erbil, and, of course, with the way that the occupation is being exercised, with the rights of Palestinians being violated on a daily basis. Putting that next to the normalization of some of these Arab countries, isn't that one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest, to make sure this region is free from outside interference? And, of course, Israel is being steered by the U.S. in some respects.
If Israel wasn't in West Asia, there would be peace throughout the region. I have absolutely no doubt about that. The fact that the Americans are there is primarily because they have this kind of bizarre commitment to an illegitimate state, which is essentially committed to expansionism through its Yinon plan, through its peripheral, so-called expansion policy as well. These are all givens that the American Congress seems absolutely incapable and, deterred in terms of trying to change policy-wise. The fact is that big Zionist capitalist corporate mafias control the bulk of American politics, and unfortunately, that is what dictates the situation in the Middle East as it is today. Now, Israel will not stop its expansionism. It's currently more paranoid than it's ever been before, predominantly because the Islamic Republic of Iran has stood tall and has managed to assemble a resistance axis which is saying no to the oppression of all the oppressed in that region, and particularly the Palestinians. So until Israel can first of all really negotiates its own self-annihilation, essentially, there will be no peace in that region, because what they're doing is buying up these other proxy states like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, and then they are pushing forward illogical, irrational foreign policies, largely which are aimed at securing the interests of Israel, not the interests of Saudi Arabia or the interests of the Bahrainis, etc. So, for instance, the war of the Saudis in Yemen does no justice to them. There's no need for them to have that war. They're so wealthy, they hardly need Yemen to become any wealthier. The war, for instance, in Syria, which the Saudis and the Gulf nations engaged in, was another war that they financed on the say-so of CENTCOM and the Israeli sort of military establishment and the big boys who want to dictate the affairs in the region. So everything is wrong about Israel being in the Middle East, just simply from the point of view of peace, prosperity, and if you like, stability. The Islamic Republic of Iran, by contrast, has not invaded any of these countries,
right.
Not for 200 years as the Iranians stepped outside of their own territories. They've been largely rather invaded. So the same Israeli and American forces imposed an eight-year war on Iran, killed over a million, soldiers or citizens one way or another of that region. Since then, they haven't stopped. Iraq, Syria, you know, up even as far as Libya, if you want to count Afghanistan, these are all bordering, mainly sure. They are bordering countries to Iran. And so, of course, that mass chaos and that warfare is what Iran is trying to avert for the future with its policies in the region now.
So, but you have to put this into context for us in terms of how this works out when you have, for example, the UAE, Kevin Barrett, courting Syria, just one of the countries, which indicates obviously there's a shift underway when it comes to Syria, along with Jordan, who has done the same, and Bahrain. And in the meantime, these are countries that have a relationship or have formalized the relationship, which, by the way, did exist before, but they just came out and formalized it to the world, with Israel. So how does that work out? I mean, when you have them reinstating Syria into the fold, so to speak, but yet at the same time have this relationship with Israel?
Well, they're trying to play both sides. And that's understandable because we're in a period of shift. The geopolitics of the region and of the world is moving fairly rapidly, perhaps increasingly so, towards this end of the unipolar American imperial era. And in the West Asian region, I agree completely with the other guest that there would be peace and prosperity absent this illegitimate Zionist entity, which is the root cause of the worst conflicts. And you know, we see how its lawlessness with the assassination of Colonel Hassan Syed Khodei the other day on Sunday, and then a couple of weeks ago, the murder of the American journalist Shireen Abu Akhla, these are just two recent examples of this kind of ridiculously lawless, psychopathic behavior from the Zionist entity. So why would these countries like the Emirates and some others that are moving towards a more rational and balanced regional policy and openly recognizing Syria, perhaps against the orders of their usual masters in Washington, why would they be moving towards friendship with the Zionist entity? Again, I think that they are kind of trying to bet on both sides or situate themselves in such a way that they can draw some sort of profit to themselves and political advantages from their seemingly friendly relations with the Zionists. But we have to remember that the change in the region is towards more independence from the imperial powers and the Zionists who run and own them. And so I think that these people who are betting on profiting from a short period of friendship with the Zionists are also seeing that in the long term, the Zionist entity is likely to go the way of the dinosaurs, and that's why they are simultaneously open to these kinds of regional peace initiatives like we're seeing with Iran and Oman.
And it's very interesting in terms of Syria. We have some more hot spots that we need to talk about, but can't leave this one alone yet, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. And that is the fact that you have what happened days ago for the first time with the Russian S-300 missile defense system actually fired shots for the first time, enacted by Russia, towards those fighter jets that had bombed Syria. And there were speculations at this point that that is because of the fact that Israel has supported Ukraine in the special military operation that Russia has done. Can you explain to us how Russia fits now into the picture when it comes to Israel, because Syria remains a country that Israel just continues to bomb, which it did again just a couple of days ago?
Well, this has been a bit of a thorny issue. But the Russians, quite clearly, whilst they came to Syria and supported the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian government in, if you like, averting the collapse of Syria, essentially, and the occupation of Syria by Zio American forces, they at the same time have been playing a balancing game. They have they have had amicable relations with Israel. Russians have many citizens that actually go and live in Israel itself. There are clear indications that the Israeli establishment goes to and fro and has largely garnered the neutrality, at least, of Russia in affairs. And in fact, there was also talk of Russia agreeing that they wouldn't use these S-300s. In fact, they wouldn't do anything to prevent Israeli warplanes dominating Syrian airspace. There seemed to be an informal agreement between all the powers as to who dominated which part of the aerial sectors. Now, one Russian plane was actually shot down accidentally, it seems, or the Israelis played a certain game in which they shadowed in such a way that the Russians weren't able to save one of their aircraft, and actually several Russians died. That didn't trigger any kind of major response from the Russians. They certainly obviously raised concerns. But what's happening now in Ukraine, it seems as though, again, where Ukraine has a large support from Israel, it also has a lot of Ukrainians who are in Israel as well. It seems as though Israel has been torn between keeping that neutrality with Russia and going in and supporting the American and NATO aggressions, essentially, in Ukraine. That's been a choice that it hasn't been able to avoid. And it seems as though some of the exchanges between Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Israelis have got very, very deep. And perhaps this could see the signal, well, it could signal the Russians taking a more hard line on Israel in West Asia as well, and particularly in Syria. That remains to be seen.
Sure. And what remains to be seen, but it seems to be on a positive track, and this could change the not only the equation on the ground, but also it's almost like a tectonic shift that's going to happen. And that is the way that Iran and Saudi Arabia have had some degree of rapprochement with each other. They are talking to each other. There has been some progress, but it's not there yet. At the same time, Saudi Arabia, it doesn't even have a channel of communication open with the U.S. President, Joe Biden. It doesn't even talk to Joe Biden, the Saudi Crown Prince, including the UAE. So if that remains that way and Iran and Saudi Arabia continue and open up embassies, for example, does that mean then that that could be the final straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the U.S. not having really the solid footing in the region any longer?
Yes, I think it would be. I think that the Saudis have played the key role in maintaining U.S. dominance of the region, and they are the swing oil producer globally. And so their importance, despite the fact that their rulers have not always been particularly competent or exemplary, they have played an outsized role in the world. And now that suddenly we see them moving out of the American orbit, as indeed the Saudi king had threatened to do in the summer of 2001, just a month before 9/11, he said that the writing is on the wall. He said it's time for, quote, the parting of the ways. And in fact, it was only the false flag operation of 9/11 that allowed the Americans and their Zionist masters to reel Saudi Arabia back into the American orbit. We could see something like that again. And if so, it will be good for the region and for the world.
I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Kevin Barrett, expert in West Asian affairs from Madison. Saim Hussein Abbas, a pleasure, from Islamabad, journalist and political analyst. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Noor Muhammad from the Islamic Seminar of Qom. Dear Sheikh, I'm very happy that you could join us today, and I thank you for your time.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Dear Sheikh, our question today, it is perhaps the first time we talk about this subject on this show.
Yeah.
And it is about the stage before death, about persons who are about to pass away from an illness. So one of our listeners have asked us, if a person is about to pass away, they're in the hospice, as we call it, they're in the hospital bed, they're about to die, and they are in a lot of pain. We know that they are about to die, he says. We do not know, but he knows. The doctors have told him perhaps he's about to die. The person himself knows he's about to die. Everybody knows it. And they are in excruciating pain. But the soul is still not leaving the body. It is still in his body, and he's still suffering. And it can be very difficult for family members to see this. So are there any supplications, any ad'iyah, some dua, that we can pray for this process to be easier for him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, we have some supplications and the verse of Noble Quran for the ease, relief of this individual. For example, we have that, let's say we have a narration that if you recite the chapter Yasin or Safat or Waqi'a, Qaf, Naz'at, and these chapters beside the individual who want to go to, you know, to pass away,
right.
Yes, it causes the relief of this individual. We have that. Or, for example, we have some supplication mentioned in the books by different scholars. I do not want to mention and go to the detail of that. Or, for example, we have some recommendations that you put it, that individual put it in the place that individual was praying, Musallah.
Yes, the place that you see offer prayers to ibadah.
Offer prayer, yeah. Because usually in our homes, we usually sometimes we on some spots we pray.
We have a special corner, a special room.
Yes, right. You're right. Or, for example, some people, they spread their sajada. Usually, for example, in that spot, I pray. It is recommended to put that individual who is passing away.
If it's difficult for them.
Yeah, to put that in order to cause some kind of relief.
A lot of etiquette, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. It is recommended to do that. Of course, we have many other, let's say, recommendation for that. Let me share the narration itself. إذا عصر على الميت موته ونضعه قرب إلى مصلاه الذي كان يصلى فيه. Just to put that individual when the time is, difficult for that individual who is passing away, put him or her beside the spot that individual was praying, okay, was used to pray in that spot. But I want to explain this issue and some kinds of step for having is